She was convinced that some of the phenomena were real. 2. Mr. Besterman attended at least 5 sessions in August 1934, during which, according to the minutes, which de Goes reports him as having signed, flowers materialized, bottles on a table jumped around, one even hopping onto the floor, a picture left the wall to float in midair and land abruptly on someone's head, a chair slid along the floor for about 10 feet, the front door key drifted out of its lock, and Myra Bailey came up with a learned written discourse in French, writing nearly 1,800 words in 53 minutes. All of which led Mr. Besterman to declare, again according to de Goes, who quotes him in English, that he found Mr. Myra Bailey's phenomena of the greatest interest. Many of them were unique of their kind. Later, however, he changed his mind, as we shall see shortly. Yuriko de Goes writes that phenomena like those mentioned above came to be mere routine, though now and then Myra Bailey would introduce such novelties as asking witnesses to indicate an unripe orange growing in the garden, then to go and pick it and find a rare coin embedded inside. On one occasion a businessman friend asked for advice about a letter he had just sent to New York. Myra Bailey told him exactly how his business deal was going. And when the reply came he sat down and dashed off translations in Portuguese, French, German and Hebrew without even looking at the original in English. For a special session in 1933 held at 9 in the morning, Myra Bailey was handcuffed, his feet bound, and then asked to repeat phenomena he had produced at a previous meeting under artificial light. He promptly obliged, freshly plucked flowers floated in through a locked and sealed window. A religious statue weighing 8 kilos drifted in after them, made the rounds of the room and drifted out again, while Myra Bailey began to talk in Arabic to one of the investigators, who identified the voice as that of his mother who had died in Beirut 28 years previously. He became a spiritist on the spot. A tray of flour was placed inside a drawer, which was locked and sealed, and after 15 minutes 3 loud raps were heard. Opening the drawer, witnesses saw the clear impression of a human hand on the flower. The lid of the water cooler took off and landed among the audience, and when one man went over to examine the cooler, it exploded in his face, soaking him with water. Finally, it was time to read the minutes of the previous meeting, at which point the group secretary, the son of a German, found he had left his spectacles at home. "Wait, son. I'll bring them right away from the room in your house where you left them," came a voice speaking German, adding, "I am your father and your protector." The spectacles promptly appeared in the secretary's hands. Myra Bailey seemed to run a kind of lost property office for his friends. While driving from Sao Paulo down to Santos with him one day, Yuriko de Goes remembered he had left his umbrella behind. As they arrived at the medium's house, it promptly dropped from the ceiling. Other property recovered via Myra Bailey's unfathomable talents included a stolen gold crucifix, a fur wrap somebody had left on a bus, and several lost or stolen documents. Some of his antics seemed no more than harmless jokes staged to prove the reality of such phenomena. When British poet and diplomat Sir Douglas Ainslie turned up for a session in a private Sao Paulo house in 1928, the first thing he saw on the hall table was the traveling clock he had left inside a suitcase in his hotel room. During the evening, the lady of the house mislaid her spectacles, which were later found in the home of one of the guests. Many phenomena seemed entirely pointless, objects simply flying around the room or moving from one shelf to another, sometimes hitting people in the process and even hurting them quite badly. De Goes was once struck on the arm by a stone, while Myra Bailey himself had a large picture smashed over his head, glass and all, at a public meeting held in a center that was not one of his own. Myra Bailey himself would claim that inferior spirits were responsible for this sort of thing, using his powers like a magnet or focal point for their pranks. This is a theory sometimes advanced today to account for poltergeist phenomena in general, and the theory of like attracts like with regard to mediums and the spirits they attract can account for much of the evidence provided elsewhere in this book. Sometimes the atmosphere was thoroughly gruesome. At one session, a human hand materialized, and Myra Beale announced that he saw the skeleton of a lady who had been buried minus her head. This, he explained, had been removed for study as she had been mentally disturbed before her death. He named the exact plot in São Paulo's R8:Section8:Cemetery where she had been buried, and said that her remains had been secretly removed and were being kept at her son's house. At the following session, after the family in question had indeed found the box of remains to be missing from the grave, a terrible smell of decomposed corpse filled the room, as bones began to materialize one after the other and fall on people's heads. Degos managed to keep control over his feelings, and his stomach, to note what appeared. There were, he meticulously recorded, humeri, radii, ulnas, carpuses, a metacarpus, fingers, ribs, parts of the vertebral column, femurs, tibias, tarsi, metatarsi, ankle bones and hair. It was, he recalled, like something out of Edgar Allan Poe. Other Myra Beelian feats read more like science fiction. One evening, after a long and tiring session, he asked for the lights to be switched off, and then with two men holding him firmly by the arms he began to glow all over, lighting up the whole room. Another time he levitated into the air while handcuffed, whereupon there was a sound of falling handcuffs as he disappeared altogether, reappearing in his nearby office which was locked from the outside, where startled witnesses burst in to find him stretched out on a chaise longue and chanting away in Latin. But the most incredible Myra Beale feat of all, one that must strain anybody's frontiers of belief, concerns the occasion when he went with a group of friends to São Paulo's Lius railway station to catch the train to São Vicente, about 50 miles away. On the platform, he simply vanished, and after 15 minutes his worried friends managed to get through by telephone to the house they were heading for in São Vicente. Myra Beale, they were told, had been there for about 15 minutes. I cannot substantiate this story, but I am surprised at the number of people I have met who believe it. Eurico Degos includes it in his book as if it were quite a normal thing for Myra Beale to do, and it should be mentioned that Degos claimed to have investigated a number of mediums other than Myra Beale, and been impressed by none of them. He was constantly on the lookout for fraud, he says, and records that whenever he was a guest at the medium's home he would always check everything personally before going to bed, searching the whole house to find an unlocked or unbarred window. Degos had nothing to gain except ridicule for his championing of a well-known and controversial medium, for during the 20s and 30s there was a great deal of hostility in the press towards anything remotely psychic or occult, and Myra Beale bore the full brunt of it. Though Degos claims that no Brazilian who actually troubled to witness him ever said or wrote a word against him. Even some Catholic priests, often hostile then as now towards any form of spiritism, could be won over by the medium's charm and apparent sincerity of purpose. A certain Father José María de Castro wrote in Myra Beale's private scrapbook, "Myra Beale is a man of faith whom the chiefs of the church in Brazil cannot condemn without knowing him." Condemned he was, all the same, and he somehow survived no less than 15 court appearances, all for allegedly legal practice of medicine or witchcraft, the former usually consisting of doing no more than magnetize a bottle of water. Although he could apparently produce accurate diagnoses of diseases while in trance, Myra Beale does not seem to have gone in for curing after the fashion of the American trance medium Edgar Cayce, or the Brazilian psychic surgeons mentioned later in this book. There was one occasion when he claimed to have received the spirit of a former sufferer from tuberculosis, and in front of witnesses he put on a realistic demonstration of a pulmonary hemorrhage, spitting half a liter of very real-looking blood all over the floor, fully recovering in half an hour. Dr. Thade de Medeiros testified that Myra Beale once spotted signs of incipient cardiac lesion and renal disturbance in a patient of his, which helped him considerably in effecting a cure. He also correctly diagnosed a serious condition in the solar plexus of another patient Dr. Medeiros had already examined, coming to the same independent conclusion. But on the whole, having Myra Beale around the surgery seems to have been more liability than asset, bottles of expensive or even dangerous medicines were liable to leap out of glass-fronted cabinets and fly across the room. Phenomena like this were frequently observed, the doctor noted. We can understand why he seems to have made little use of his medium friend's services. Myra Bealey's clinical methods during such healing as he did were, as we might expect, unusual. A prominent society lady calling on him in 1933 reported feeling something invisible touching her near the heart. Oh yes, Myra Bealey assured her at once, that would be Dr. Oswaldo Cruz, highly respected in Brazil as a pioneer of tropical medicine. He's saying that you're taking too much of a medicine you're carrying with you, the medium announced. He's going to. There was a crash, as a bottle of Atafan was thrown violently against the wall, shattering into small pieces. It was the bottle the woman had been carrying inside her handbag. Oswaldo Cruz says, Myra Bealey went on, unperturbed, that you got a prescription from a medium. You can go on taking the medicine that the spirit prescribed for you. Whereupon another bottle, this time of Antimopolis and also from the startled lady's handbag, was thrown onto the floor without breaking. There seems to have been no limit to what the man could produce, in or out of trance. His artistic output in the latter condition was fairly impressive. He could paint in a number of different styles, produce portraits of dead people which were identified by surviving relatives, 50 paintings of his were once exhibited in Amsterdam, and also conjure musical phenomena out of thin air. Witnesses recall having heard ethereal concerts in his presence, ranging from snatches of opera to military fanfares, while the musically untrained Myra Bealey, who was untrained in practically everything else as well, come to that, would sing lengthy arias in a number of languages, often while doing something else at the same time, like writing or painting. His inspiration could also take a practical turn. Once he was lamenting the fact that his record player was out of action, whereupon the machine switched itself on and the needle placed itself on a disc, this before the invention of the automatic turntable. What, it may be asked, was the point of all this sort of thing? The apparent purpose behind the Myra Bealey manifestations was to prove the existence of spirits and the validity of the spiritist doctrine as drawn up by Karg. This is the purpose of all spiritist meetings, though nowadays physical phenomena are regarded as rather old-fashioned stuff, no longer needed to support the faith of veteran Kardecists. The only evidence for Myra Bealey's doctrinaire intentions comes from the examples of his automatic writing, many of which have been published in Brazil, and of which I have seen several photocopies but unfortunately no originals. These are thought to exist, but after his death there was some confusion in the family as to who inherited what, and even the two of Myra Bealey's sons I was able to locate had no idea where they were. At one typical 1928 session, Myra Bealey produced messages purporting to come from Saint Simon, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux and Louis XII, all in French, Martin Luther, German, and a fellow who signs himself G. Knox the Quaker, English. Saint Simon comes across in elegant French, making an earnest plea for concentration on the principles of spiritism and concluding voilà Maura. Et reviver encore, cet est la loi établie par Alan Karg. The others say much the same thing in their own languages, while the final message, from Mr. Knox, concludes, therefore I can do no more than confirm all M. Bernard de Clairvaux's doctrines, for its author knows better than I what is truth, as he already reached the lightest places in sky among the angels and nearer of God than I'm, sick. Goodbye. Bible and sword. Messages would come through in all usual European languages, plus a few less usual ones such as Catalan, Albanian and Bulgarian, also in a number of Oriental languages including Japanese and Chinese. Most of them are neatly written, though spelling mistakes are common, and their subject matter varies enormously. De Goes lists discourses on Great Britain and the Irish question, Slav psychology, the Russo-Japanese war, inhabitable planets and Buddha among several others. They contain nothing revelationary, but show evidence of more knowledge than a busy man with no special educational qualifications would be expected to have amassed in his spare time. Some of the messages have an intriguing ring of authenticity. Cromwell, for instance, gives a long and rambling account of a nightmare he had in which King Charles had cut his head off, which is quite an entertaining little essay in its own right. Joan of Arc comes over with a stirring denunciation of the Church. Jeanne Malfoy's, she writes, La basse et noire croyance qui est l'église catholique, qui malgré voyerit causa Therese de ma mort, je la colonne maillard avec mes cendres et ossements. La victime hearest sanctifie passes propres bruxed misure lautuil. Messages such as these made little impression on the Society of Psychical Research, which noticed a collection of them in its journal for October 1927, dismissing them along with accounts of other Mirabilis miracles as preposterous, hardly a scientific attitude, and especially curious coming from Mrs. Helen Salter, herself a prolific automatic writer and member of the team that produced the celebrated Myers Cross correspondences, some of the best evidence for human survival of bodily death ever gathered. Another collection of Mirabiliano was reviewed by Theodore Besterman in the SPR Journal for November 1930. He pointed out reasonably that there was no evidence of supernormal knowledge in the messages, but overstated his case by claiming that there was nothing in them beyond the reach of Mirabili's linguistic associations and comparatively good education. All witnesses I have interviewed agree without hesitation that Mirabili could not even speak either of his own languages, Italian and Portuguese, correctly. A more open-minded attitude was expressed by Dr. E. J. Dingwall, in a review of a German translation of an early Mirabili book that came out in 1960. He laments the fact that the Mirabili case remains another of those unsolved mysteries with which the history of parapsychology abounds, and takes his former SPR colleagues to task for not having collected evidence from eyewitnesses of the phenomena. 3. Fortunately, I was able to collect some evidence that might help at least partially solve the great Mirabili mystery. I set out in 1973 to track down survivors of Mirabili sessions who had witnessed paranormal phenomena at first hand, and were prepared to talk about them. It was no easy task. Though many of my friends in the Spiritist movement were able to produce a wealth of second-hand evidence, one eminent São Paulo surgeon assured me that his father had seen Mirabili leave the floor while sitting in a chair, I could find only a handful of men who had known him over a long period of time, and most of these were too old to remember anything clearly except that the medium had been a source of inspiration to their spiritual development. This was comforting, but of little evidential value. It did suggest that Mirabili was an effective saver of souls after his unusual fashion, a point not to be overlooked. The general picture that soon began to emerge was that Mirabili definitely had abilities as a medium, though he did not develop them fully and very probably resorted to trickery on his off days. He also attracted a definitely second-rate variety of spirit, I was assured. An oculist, who should be able to believe his own eyes, described a partial materialization he had witnessed, of a human figure that began to form inside a circle of people holding hands, including Mirabili, but suddenly vanished before it took identifiable shape. This was an encouraging start, and after much further inquiry I was able to gather far more detailed evidence from two of Mirabili's sons, insisting to each that they only describe what they saw with their own eyes, and making allowances for the fact that no son is likely to denounce his own father as a fraud. First, I sought out Regine Mirabili, a businessman and accomplished amateur hypnotist with a keen interest in the scientific rather than the spiritual side of psychical research. Regine had no doubts whatsoever as to his father's abilities, and flatly denied my suggestion that hypnotism had played any part in them. Since his parents had separated amicably shortly after his birth, Regine saw little of his father until he was 10 years old. Almost on their first meeting, things began to happen. I was sitting on the arm of a heavy Renaissance-style sofa, Regine told me. Father liked me to stroke his hair, and I was doing this when the sofa simply began to move, with both of us sitting on it. Then I clearly saw the shadow of a figure on the floor in front of us. There was sunlight coming through a heavy glass window beside the sofa. Then the door of the cupboard across the room opened and a quill pen came out and was shot into the wooden floor like an arrow. All of which sent young Regine rushing out of the room in terror, screaming for his mother. But there was more to come. Out in the hallway there was a heavy brass cuspid door that had fallen over, blocking the passage. We heard loud bangs and crashes coming from a room beyond, and when I rushed in, there was Mother lying on the floor with every piece of the furniture in the room on top of her. She wasn't hurt because they had the consideration to place a thick mattress over her first. One night, when Myra Beale's old friend Miguel Carl was staying in the house, Regine happened to peep through a crack in the door to have a look at the visitor, who was sitting on the bed with the light on, his arms folded in front of him in a position of meditation. As I watched him, he told me, his body began to rise up in the air, without changing position. Then he just stayed there, in midair, about a meter off the bed, his arms and legs still crossed. That was enough for me, and I ran off to tell Mother as fast as I could. Mother, however, was quite used to this sort of thing, and one can appreciate why she had opted out of the family. You can imagine what it was like for her, Regine said, spending half an hour laying the table, for instance, and then when her back was turned finding everything flung all over the room. How could you run a kitchen in a house like that? Another evening, Regine joined a session consisting of the family and a dozen friends, which was being held to help a bedridden invalid in another room. This was an occasion he will never forget. Father told us all to form a current, and he said not to worry about any phenomena that might happen. I was sitting about 2 meters from a table where there were 3 bottles of water, corked. This was to be fluidized and used to treat the sick man. We all sat there, and suddenly the bottles rose into the air, about 30 centimeters, and we heard 3 clinks as each struck the other. Then the bottles slowly began to turn over in midair, and stayed like that, upside down for a moment or two. I could see them very clearly, and the water inside them seemed to have gone solid, for it stayed in position, with a gap just under the cork. Then all the bottles fell hard onto the table and rolled about, although they did not break. Regine Myra Beale assured me that none of his family have inherited any of his father's talents, though of those talents there could be no doubt at all. He was the greatest medium since Jesus Christ, he summed up. Cesare Augusto Myra Beale, the medium's youngest son, provided me with the kind of clear and straightforward evidence that would make research of this kind easy if there were more of it to be had from key witnesses. Providing clear evidence was indeed part of his job as an investigator in the Sao Paulo Police Force Flying Squad. As we discussed his father's mediumship, Cesare would think hard before answering, choosing his words as if giving evidence in court, as he often had to do. He made it clear at the start of our interview that he was far from sympathetic towards spiritism in general. "I have always accepted spiritist facts," he told me. "But I never accepted the spiritist religion. 99% of what is known as spiritism is deceit, mystification or bad faith. If my father were a fraud, I would certainly say so." As an investigator himself, I asked, was he fully satisfied that his father had really caused psychic phenomena without any possible collusion or trickery of any kind? "Well," Cesare replied with a smile, "I'm a suspect when it comes to testifying to the authenticity and honesty of these phenomena, being his son. But, you may not believe it, I would never take part in a conspiracy aimed at deceiving so many people. The facts really were true. Fraud was impossible, bearing in mind the locations, even out in the street in broad daylight where there was no chance of previous preparation. The phenomena were often produced just for us, the family. Now, if there had been any intention to mystify people, this should have been done to others, but why us?" One night, for instance, Cesare was coming home with his mother and father after a visit to friends. As they entered the house, a shower of rose petals fell on their heads just inside the door. This struck me as something that could easily have been prepared beforehand, but I could not say the same of the next phenomenon Caesar recalled for me. We had an ornamental porcelain vase, about 60 centimeters high, weighing I suppose 3 to 4 kilos, standing on a kind of tripod. There were only us in the house. Suddenly, Father started to look at the corner where the vase was, and I started to look as well. Then the vase just rose into the air, about 40 centimeters up. Then all at once it turned, picked up speed and smashed itself to pieces against the wall, 2 meters away. Wasn't he curious about this sort of thing at the time? I wondered. Yes, I was, he replied, but I thought it quite natural because of the frequency and the naturalness of the phenomena. They just happened almost every day, any time and any place. Were these phenomena connected with what your father was doing at the time? I asked. Some things that happened were unforeseen, even by him, Caesar answered. Could he provoke a phenomenon deliberately? Yes, he could if he concentrated. But sometimes they occurred independently of his will. Finally, I mentioned the question of levitation, one of the most difficult of all phenomena to accept for anybody like myself who has never seen one. Caesar told me he had not been present on the celebrated occasion his father was supposed to have been levitated almost to the ceiling during a session at Rue Annatel 9, the building constructed to house the Spiritist Center next door to the family home at No. 11. On a visit to this house, I checked the background of a photograph showing Myra Bealey in midair and found it exactly matched, the same light fitting being still there today. Yuri Kodagos accepted the photo as genuine, though the shadow on the wall seems to have been retouched, as I will describe later. But, Caesar went on, since levitation means the displacement of the mass of any body with relation to its gravity. Here again was the professional investigator speaking, rather than the son of a spiritist medium. Apostrophe. I did have the opportunity to witness other examples of objects that moved from one place to another. There was, he said, one particular occasion he would never forget. Some building work was being done in the house, and a pile of bricks stood in the corridor. I started to imitate Father's gestures, just for fun, because at times I really used to think his attitudes were rather comic. Then a brick suddenly fell on the floor beside me. I looked around, there was nobody there, and then another brick fell, and another. I started to run, and bricks began to fly all over the place. I ran and ran, all round the house, and at the end of the passage there was a big iron door. As I was trying to get it open, another brick was flung against it. Didn't that scare the life out of you? I interrupted to ask. Well, although I was only a child, I distinctly felt that the bricks were not exactly being aimed at me. Whoever was throwing them didn't want to hit me. Anyway, I finally got outside and ran across the road to a small football pitch we had there. Then I started to yell, I was afraid to go home. Father appeared at the window and I told him to stay there and keep a lookout while I went back into the house. At first, I thought he must have been playing tricks with me because he was all covered with brick dust as well. He had been sitting on his rocking chair and bricks had been dropped all over him, though he wasn't hurt. He couldn't have been throwing them himself, though, as I had really been running all over the place. Caesar's most vivid memory of his father was a tragic one, that of the day he was killed. It was April 30th, 1951, and the two of them were on their way to the cinema when Myra Bealey decided to cross the road to buy something. Caesar stayed chatting with a shoeshine boy, and as his father was walking across the road, a car came round a bend and hit him, causing a cranial lesion that put him into a coma from which he never recovered. It was a black 1938 Ford, said Caesar, ever the conscientious observer. One man who had not forgotten Myra Bealey more than 20 years after his death was Fenelon Alves Feitosa, a courteous and kindly Brazilian of the old school now rapidly vanishing in ultramaterialistic São Paulo, who ran his real estate business from an office in the heart of the city's commercial district. When I called to see him, he opened the top drawer of his desk and produced a small pile of literature on Myra Bealey, as if it were the most urgent business of the day even now. For my benefit, Fenelon recalled an outing he had spent with the professor as Myra Beale was known to all 30 years previously, remembering it as clearly as if it had taken place the day before and giving a vivid impression of what life with Myra Beale had really been like. One day in 1943, for example, Myra Beale invited Fenelon to join him on a trip to Iberê! Some 250 miles from São Paulo, to visit a certain Joaquim Seixas who lived there. The two of them took the night train, arriving early in the morning and being warmly welcomed by Mr. Seixas and his family. Fenelon had slept little during the journey, and immediately went to take a bath and clean himself up. He was still in the bath and covered with soap when he heard Myra Beale calling, "Fenelon, Fenelon, come here quickly." "I dried myself and dressed hurriedly," Fenelon recalled, "and ran into the living room, where I found the professor linked by a chain of hands to Mr. and Mrs. Seixas and two or three other members of their family. As I came in, the professor cried, 'Fenelon,